Welcome to the Deep Dive. Ever wondered why your mobile phone plan feels, well, so limited, even with a few different companies?
Mm-hmm.
Or, flip side, why you've got a million choices for coffee, but usually just one option for your water supply?
Right. These aren't accidents.
Exactly. Today, we're digging into the hidden architecture behind all that. It governs every purchase, every price. We're talking market structures.
And it might sound a bit... yeah, textbooky.
Yeah, a bit dry maybe.
But it's actually a shortcut. It helps you understand the chessboard companies are playing on, why prices land where they do.
And why some industries feel super competitive, while others seem more like, I don't know, a quiet empire.
That's it. Our source material lays it out really clearly. It shows how markets are defined by some key things.
Okay.
Like how many buyers and sellers are there? Are the products different or basically the same? How easy is it for new companies to jump in or for existing ones to leave?
And how much does everyone actually know? Information availability.
Precisely. And this deep dive is all about peeling back those layers, seeing the economic game underneath, maybe even figuring out the next move.
Yeah, expect some real aha moments today. We're connecting these sort of abstract ideas to things you see every single day. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
So first things first. What do we actually mean by a market here? It's not just a shop or a website, is it?
No, not really. It's more of a framework, an arena, almost, where exchange happens.
And our source points to four key features. These are the things that let us classify any market, right?
Yeah.
And predict behavior.
Exactly. They're foundational.
So, number one, the number of buyers and sellers, just how many folks are playing?
Right. Lots. Few. Just one.
Number two, product differentiation. Are we talking identical widgets, like basic grains, or are they unique, like different smartphone brands?
A really key distinction.
Third, freedom of entry and exit. How easy is it to get in the game? Or get out if things go south? Are the doors wide open or bolted shut?
Mm-hmm. Barriers are huge.
And fourth, information. Does everyone know the score? Do buyers and sellers have all the info they need? Or is it, like, hidden?
Yeah, what's fascinating, truly, is how these, well, seemingly simple characteristics drive completely different market dynamics.
Okay.
Understanding these is fundamental. It's like having the rule book. Lets you predict how firms might act, how prices get set, what the outcome might be. It's the bedrock.
Right. So, with those four features as our guide, let's walk across the spectrum of competition, from markets packed with players to, well, just one.
Mm-hmm.
So, at one extreme, we've got perfect competition. This is like the theoretical ideal, isn't it? Almost mythical.
You could say that, yeah.
You've got tons of buyers, tons of sellers, and crucially, they're all trading identical products, homogenous.
No difference at all.
Plus, perfect information, everyone knows everything, and complete freedom of entry and exit. Firms here are just price takers.
Meaning they have zero power to set prices. They just take whatever the market gives them.
The classic examples, though maybe not perfectly perfect, are things like big agricultural markets, right? Wheat, maybe. Eggs.
Exactly. One farmer's wheat is pretty much the same as the next farmer's. It's a commodity.
So why is this model useful if it's so rare in its pure form?
Well, it's a vital benchmark. It shows us what happens when competition is absolutely maxed out. No holds barred.
Okay.
Even if it's rare, it provides that baseline. It shows a market where no single player has any clout, which really forces efficiency.
Okay, so perfect competitors are always scrambling. What happens when firms get a little more, say, maybe some control over their product?
Now we move into monopolistic competition. This is something you definitely see everywhere.
Right. Still lots of sellers, but the key difference is their products are slightly differentiated.
Yeah, not totally unique, but different enough. Think branding, maybe design, service levels.
And the barriers to get in are still pretty low, right? It's not too hard to open, say, a new coffee shop.
Generally, yes.
So examples are everywhere. Restaurants, clothing stores, shampoos, like you said.
Absolutely. Your favorite local pizza place, those different clothing brands at the mall, all the soaps on the shelf. They're selling similar stuff, but each tries to carve out its own little space.
And this is where things like advertising and packaging non-price competition become really important. They're trying to convince you their slightly different version is better.
Precisely. That differentiation gives them a tiny bit of price control. Just a smidge.
But it's limited.
Very limited. Because there's so many other choices, right?
Right.
If one cafe raises prices too much, you'll just walk down the street to another one.
Makes sense. Okay, moving further along, what's next? Oligopoly.
Now things get concentrated. Oligopoly is where just a few large firms dominate the entire market.
Okay, so few. is the key word.
And their products. They could be pretty similar, like maybe industrial chemicals.
Yeah.
Or they could be highly differentiated. I think cars, smartphones, airlines.
Right.
But the absolute defining feature here is interdependence.
Interdependence, meaning?
Meaning, because there are so few big players, each one has to constantly think about how its rivals will react to anything it does.
Ah, like a chess game.
Exactly like a chess game. Before you make a move, especially on pricing or launching your product, you have to anticipate what the other guy's going to do.
And this leads to prices being kind of sticky. They don't change much.
Often, yes. Price rigidity is common.
Right.
Nobody wants to kick off a price war that could hurt everyone. It's too risky.
Yeah, you see that with airlines sometimes, or mobile phone plans. The big players seem to move in lockstep almost.
Mm-hmm. Or think soft drinks, cars. These are classic oligopoly examples. They're always watching each other like hawks.
Okay, so that leaves the final stop on our spectrum, the complete opposite of perfect competition, monopoly.
The extreme end. Here you have only one firm. A single seller.
Supplying a product that's unique, right? With no close substitutes available.
Correct. Which means, unlike the poor farmer in perfect competition, the monopolist is a price maker.
They set the price, take it or leave it.
Pretty much. And the reason they can do this, the reason a monopoly can even exist and stick around, comes down to one thing.
Let me guess. Barriers to entry.
Extremely high barriers to entry. That's the secret sauce. Without those massive walls keeping competitors out, others would rush in and the monopoly would dissolve.
Got it. And our sources mentioned there are different types of monopolies, right? They don't all form the same way.
That's right. There's the natural monopoly. Think about your local water company.
Okay.
It's just way more efficient, cheaper for one company to build and run that huge network of pipes than for, say, three companies to try and do it side by side. The cost structure naturally leads to one provider.
Okay, that makes sense. Then what?
Then you have government monopolies. These are state-owned or state-controlled, like historically the Postal Service in many countries.
Right. And technology can create one too.
Absolutely. A technological monopoly. This comes from innovation, maybe a patent on a new drug or a groundbreaking piece of software, gives the company exclusive rights for a period.
And finally, just being the only game in town.
Geographical monopoly. Simple as that. The only gas station for 200 miles in the desert. Or the only general store in a really remote village. Location, location, location creates the monopoly.
Fascinating how they can arise from such different circumstances. So we keep mentioning these barriers. Let's dive into those bouncers at the door a bit more.
Yeah, barriers to entry and exit. These are crucial because they're what protect firms, especially in those markets that aren't perfectly competitive. Oligopolies, monopolies. They rely on these.
So what kinds are there? The sources break them down.
They do. First, you've got legal barriers. Think patents, like we just mentioned, for tech monopolies. Or government licenses needed to operate, say, a TV station or a utility. Copyrights, too. The law itself keeps others out.
Okay, legal hurdles. What else?
Then market barriers. This is more about customer behavior and existing advantages. Think intense brand loyalty.
Like trying to launch a new cola against Coke or Pepsi.
Exactly. It's incredibly hard to persuade those loyal customers to switch. Another one is customer switching costs.
Ah, the hassle factor. Like changing your bank account or maybe your mobile phone provider, even if you want to.
Precisely. It takes time, effort, maybe even money, so you just stick with what you have.
Yeah.
Product differentiation itself could be a barrier, too.
Makes sense. What about costs? Money barriers?
Big ones. Cost barriers. Sometimes the startup costs are just astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
Think building a car factory or a semiconductor plant.
Requires billions.
Right. Or economies of scale. Existing large firms might produce things so cheaply because of their size that a small newcomer just can't compete on price. They get crushed.
And sunk costs, what are those again?
Sunk costs are costs you've spent that you absolutely cannot get back if you decide to leave the market. Think highly specialized equipment that nobody else wants, or huge advertising campaigns.
So it makes entering risky, because if it fails, you lose that money for good.
Exactly. It raises the stakes significantly. And finally, there are sometimes physical barriers.
Like actually owning the only source of something.
Could be. Owning essential infrastructure, like the only railway line into a port, controlling key distribution networks, or having exclusive access to a natural resource or a prime location.
Wow. So these barriers are really the key to understanding why some industries just stay dominated by the same few players for decades.
Absolutely. They shape the whole competitive landscape. They determine how much power firms actually have.
Okay, so we know the structures, we know the barriers. Let's talk about how firms actually, play the game within these structures, their performance, their behavior.
Right. Let's start with revenue dynamics. Basic concepts, but crucial. Total revenue, average revenue, marginal revenue.
TRARMR. Not just accounting terms, though, right? You said they're like the firm's pulse. How does a monopoly feel its revenue differently than, say, our wheat farmer?
That's a good way to think about it. For the wheat farmer, perfect competition. Average revenue and marginal revenue are the same thing. They're just the market price. It's a flat horizontal line.
Because they can sell more wheat without changing the price for anyone.
Exactly. But for any firm facing imperfect competition, a monopolist, an oligopolist, even monopolistic competition, it's different. Both their average revenue and marginal revenue curves slope downwards.
Meaning they have to lower the price to sell more.
Right. And here's the really critical bit. The marginal revenue curve is always below the average revenue curve.
Why is that again?
Because to sell one extra unit, they don't just lower the price on that unit, they have to lower the price on all the units they're selling. That price cut across all units pulls the extra revenue from that last unit down sharply.
Ah, okay. So the revenue from selling one more isn't just the price of that one more, it's the price minus the loss on all the previous ones from the price cut.
You got it. And that fundamentally changes how they decide how much to produce. It's all about comparing that marginal revenue to their marginal cost.
Which naturally leads us to profits and output, short run versus long run. Let's define profits quickly. Normal profit.
Normal profit is basically the break-even point in economic terms. Total revenue just covers total cost, including the opportunity cost, what the resources could have earned elsewhere. It's enough to keep the business going, but that's it.
And normal profit.
That's the juicy stuff. Total revenue is greater than total cost. You're earning more than just covering costs and opportunity costs. It's pure economic profit, also called supernormal profit sometimes.
Okay. Now, how does market structure affect whether firms can get and keep those abnormal profits?
Hugely. This is where structure is destiny almost. In perfect competition, sure, a firm might stumble into abnormal profits in the short run. Maybe costs drop suddenly.
Right.
But because entry is totally free, those profits act like a magnet. New firms see the money being made, they flood into the market, supply increases, price gets driven down.
And zap, profit's gone. Back to normal profit only in the long run.
Exactly. It's a relentless process. But contrast that with a monopoly.
Barriers.
Exactly. Because of those high barriers to entry, new firms can't flood in. So the monopolist can potentially rake in abnormal profits, not just in the short run, but potentially indefinitely, in the long run too.
They're protected by those barriers.
They are. That market power can be sustained.
So, given all that, when does a firm just say, enough's enough, I'm out? The shutdown decision?
Yeah, there are critical thresholds, economic escape hatches, as you put it earlier. In the short run, the decision is about covering variable costs.
The day-to-day running costs, wages, materials.
Right. If the price they can get for their product falls below their average variable cost, P is less than ABC, they should shut down immediately, even in the short run.
Why? They still have fixed costs to pay, right? Like rent.
They do. But if P is less than ABC, then every single unit they produce isn't even covering its own variable cost. So producing actually adds to their losses compared to just shutting down and only paying the fixed costs.
Okay, stop the bleeding, basically, and the long run decision.
In the long run, all costs are variable, essentially. The firm looks at its average total cost ATC, which includes fixed costs. If the price falls below the average total cost P less than ATC, the firm cannot cover all its costs over the long haul. It's not sustainable. It should exit the market completely.
So PAVC for short run shutdown, PATC for long run exit. These are really survival thresholds.
Absolutely. Life or death for the firm.
Okay. Now let's shift to efficiency. We often hear perfect competition is the most efficient. What does that mean?
It usually refers to two types of efficiency. First, productive efficiency. That means producing goods or services using the fewest possible resources, operating at the lowest point on the average total cost curve, getting the most output from inputs.
Least waste.
Exactly. And second, allocative efficiency. This is about producing the right mix of goods and services that society actually wants. Technically, it occurs where the price people are willing to pay, which reflects marginal benefit, equals the marginal cost of producing it, PMC.
And perfect competition achieves both.
In the long run, yes. The intense competition forces firms to minimize costs, productive efficiency, and prices get driven down to the marginal cost level. Allocative efficiency.
But what about the other structures? Monopolies, oligopolies, they're often seen as less efficient.
Often, yes. And one interesting concept here is X inefficiency.
X inefficiency? What's that? Sounds mysterious.
It basically means organizational slack, waste. It happens when firms aren't operating on their lowest possible cost curve because there's just not enough competitive pressure to force them to be lean and mean.
So monopolies or oligopolies might get a bit comfortable. Lazy, even.
You could say that. Poor management, maybe unnecessary perks, inefficient processes, costs creep up because there isn't that constant threat of being undercut by a more efficient rival. They can afford to be a bit bloated.
So less competition can lead to this internal waste. But does slack competition always mean less innovation?
Ah, that's the big debate. X inefficiency suggests, yes, they might get complacent. But on the other hand, think about dynamic efficiency. This is about innovation, developing new products, new processes over time.
Okay.
And monopolies, because they can earn those sustained abnormal profits, actually have the funds to invest heavily in research and development.
Ah, so they have the means for big, risky innovation projects that a perfectly competitive firm just scraping by could never afford.
Exactly. So a monopoly could be dynamically efficient, driving significant innovation, even if it's productively or allocatively inefficient in the short term. Think Bell Labs in its heyday, maybe. It's a trade-off.
Interesting tension there. Okay, let's talk strategy. Firms aren't just passive, right? They make moves. What about contestable markets?
This is a really powerful idea. A contestable market isn't defined by how many firms are in it right now, but by the ease of entering and exiting.
So, low barriers again, especially low sunk costs.
Exactly. Free entry, free exit, and importantly, low or zero sunk costs. If those conditions hold, even if there's only one or two firms currently in the market,
they have to act like they're in a competitive market.
Precisely, because the threat of new entrants is always looming. If the existing firms try to jack up prices and make big abnormal profits,
new firms can quickly jump in, grab some of that profit, and then jump out again without losing much if things get tough, like hit and run entry.
You nailed it. That potential competition, that contestability, is enough to keep prices down near the competitive level and profits close to normal. It shows competition can come from the threat of entry, not just actual rivals.
Clever. Now, firms also compete in different ways, right? Price versus non-price competition.
Definitely. Price competition is the obvious one. Lower your price to steal customers.
But that sounds dangerous, especially in an oligopoly. Could lead to a price war.
Very risky. Price wars often mean everyone loses. Profits plummet. It's like that game of chicken who blinks first.
So often, firms prefer to compete in other ways. Non-price competition.
Much more common in monopolistic competition and oligopoly, yeah. This is all about differentiating your product or service without cutting the price.
Like what? Better branding. Advertising.
Yep. Branding, advertising, improving quality, offering better customer service, after-sales support, maybe unique packaging or design features. Anything to make your product seem more attractive without starting a damaging price fight.
Trying to build loyalty that way.
Exactly.
Okay, and sticking with oligopoly, sometimes firms try, well, not competing at all, collusion.
Right. This is the dark side, potentially. Collusion is when firms secretly, or sometimes openly, agree to coordinate their actions to restrict competition.
Like fixing prices, or agreeing to limit how much they produce to keep prices high.
Those are the main ones. They essentially try to act together like a single monopolist forming a cartel. OPEC, the oil cartel, is the most famous example, though its effectiveness varies.
But isn't this usually illegal? Antitrust laws.
In most developed economies, yes, explicit collusion, like price fixing, is highly illegal and carries heavy penalties. Tacit collusion, where firms coordinate without an explicit agreement, is harder to prove, but still frowned upon.
So why do firms even try it? And why does it often fail? This brings in game theory, doesn't it? The prisoner's dilemma.
Perfectly illustrates the problem. The prisoner's dilemma is a classic concept from game theory. Imagine two suspects arrested for a crime.
And they're interrogated separately. If they both stay silent, they get a short sentence. If one confesses and implicates the other, the confessor goes free and the silent one gets a long sentence. If both confess, they both get a medium sentence.
Exactly. And the dilemma is, even though the bet collective outcome is for both to stay silent, the individual incentive for each prisoner acting rationally in their own self-interest is to confess, fearing the other one will. So they often end up both confessing, which is worse for both of them than if they cooperate.
So how does this apply to firms colluding?
Same logic. Imagine two airlines in an oligopoly secretly agree to keep prices high. That's like both prisoners staying silent. Best outcome for the group.
Okay.
But each airline knows that if it secretly cuts its price just a little while the other sticks to the agreement, it can steal a huge chunk of the market and make massive profits, at least temporarily. That's the temptation to confess.
So there's a massive incentive for each individual firm to cheat on the cartel agreement.
A massive incentive. And because they know the other firm also has that same incentive to cheat, they often both end up cheating, cutting prices, and the collusion falls apart. The whole agreement collapses.
Even though they'd all be better off if they could just trust each other and stick to the high price.
Right. Game theory, often using a simple payoff matrix table to show these choices and outcomes, reveals this inherent instability in collusion. It highlights that complex strategic interdependence. It's fascinating stuff.
It really is. Okay, one last piece of the puzzle. How do we actually measure all this market power? How do we know if an industry is an oligopoly or closer to competition?
A common tool economists and regulators use is the concentration ratio.
Concentration ratio, what does it measure?
It measures the percentage of total market sales, or market share, accounted for by the largest few firms in the industry. Usually they look at the top four firms, CR4, or maybe the top eight firms, CR8.
So if the top four firms control, say, 80% of the market.
That's a high CR4. It tells you immediately that the market is highly concentrated. There's likely significant market power held by those top players, and it probably behaves like an oligopoly.
Whereas a low CR4, maybe 20%, it suggests a much more competitive market, closer to monopolistic competition, perhaps.
Exactly. It's a quick snapshot of market structure. It's not perfect. It doesn't tell you everything about competition.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really common and useful starting point for identifying oligopolies and assessing how competitive an industry might be.
So when regulators are deciding whether to approve a merger, they'd look at how it impacts the concentration ratio.
Very likely, yes. If a merger would significantly increase the concentration ratio in an already concentrated market, regulators might block it on antitrust grounds, fearing it would reduce competition too much. It helps quantify market dominance.
Got it. Phew, we've covered a lot of ground there.
We have. From perfect competition to monopoly, barriers, profits, efficiency, strategy.
So bringing it all together, this deep dive really does give you a new lens, doesn't it? A way to look at the economy around you.
Absolutely.
You can start spotting the difference between a price maker and a price taker. You can think about why some industries seem stuck while others are constantly innovating, or why some feel ripe for collusion.
And knowing about these structures helps you make sense of business news, right? When you read about regulatory action or a price war or a company's math of profits, you have a framework to understand why it might be happening.
It even helps as a consumer, maybe understanding the choices you have or don't have.
Definitely. It's about seeing those underlying economic forces and strategic games playing out all around us.
So the next time you're choosing, I don't know, a brand of breakfast cereal, maybe pause for a second. Are you looking at genuine, robust, monopolistic competition? Or is powerful branding subtly steering you? Or when you read about the latest tech giant making waves, ask yourself, what kind of barriers, maybe invisible ones, are they building around their digital empire?
Are you seeing real competition? Or is it more like watching a carefully orchestrated economic game being played out right there in front of you?
Something to think about. Keep your eyes peeled for these structures in your daily life.